Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. We've been talking all week about the disappearance of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was last seen outside of a Saudi consulate in Turkey on October 2nd. Turkish officials have said they have audio recordings that prove he was tortured and murdered. And today, in a pro-government newspaper in Turkey, some details of the torture were published. And the details are gruesome. They include severing his fingers during an interrogation before beheading Khashoggi and dismembering his body. Today in the Oval Office, President Trump called Saudi Arabia a very important ally and was asked about the audio recordings.
President, why would I tell you?
Have you asked for this audio video intelligence that the Turks supposed to
We have asked for it if it exists. We have asked for it.
Yeah. But you haven't gotten
We've asked for it if it exists.
Are you surprised that they haven't turned it over?
No, I'm not sure yet that it exists. Probably does. Possibly does. I'll have a full report on that from Mike when he comes back.
The president there referring to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who visited with leaders in both Turkey and Saudi Arabia this week. In a statement, Pompeo said the Saudi leaders would investigate the matter and that they continued to deny any involvement in Khashoggi's disappearance. The incident has highlighted international concern over the Saudi regime's human rights abuses, and there have been reports of an increase of women and other activists being arrested and detained. This week, we're spending some time trying to better understand the United States' relationship with Saudi Arabia. Yesterday, we looked at the economic ties between the two countries, and today, we turn to their record on human rights. Sarah Lee Whitson is the executive director of the Middle East and North Africa Division with Human Rights Watch, and she joins me now in studio. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
So let's talk a little bit about Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Since he came to power in 2017, what's his record been so far on human rights?
Well, his record has been quite bad, actually, probably far worse than his predecessors exercising power in Saudi Arabia, because he has not only arrested and jailed activists who have been the traditional targets of Saudi repression, but he's gone far, far wider in an effort to consolidate all power in the country. So going after the business establishment, going after other royals who may have independent voices, independent bases of support, as well as the religious establishment, basically the pillars of the Saudi royal family's support, in an effort to wipe out any avenue of questioning of his own rule. In addition, he's launched a catastrophic war in Yemen, completely unnecessary war, launching thousands of airstrikes against the civilian population in the country, creating a humanitarian catastrophe that is now leaving 13 million Yemenis on the brink of starvation, according to the UN's report this week.
Let's talk a little bit about the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. What is Saudi Arabia's interest in that country?
Well, Saudi Arabia's purported interest in that country is to keep the country as its zone of influence, where it exercises close control over government in that region. Its stated reason for going to war in Yemen is to, it's somewhat funny to say, but restore the democratically elected President Hadi, who was overthrown in a coup by Houthi forces allied with the prior president, now deceased. The real reason that many analysts believe that Saudi Arabia has gone to war in Yemen under the Crown Prince's rulership is that he wanted to have a quick military victory in Yemen as a feather in his cap as now the Minister of Defense, the new Minister of Defense, because among the many portfolios that the Crown Prince has amassed for himself in addition to Minister of the Economy is, of course, Minister of Defense for someone who has had zero defense experience. And so the idea was that this would establish his bona fides as a military leader with a quick victory to reassert control over a militia that had taken control over Yemen and show that he would be a strong regional leader. Saudi, of course, now claims that the reason it was to avoid turning Yemen into an Iranian proxy state. But of course, when they went to war, there was very little evidence of Iranian involvement in Yemen.
I want to turn back to what's happening in within Saudi Arabia. And there have been reports, as we mentioned in the opening, of an increase in women and other activists who've been arrested and detained. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those examples?
Sure. So if you understand what Crown Prince has done from the perspective of an absolute and total concentration of power, and that any changes that are coming in the kingdom are coming by his decision and his decision only, by absolute fiat, it was important for him to jail women activists who had for years campaigned, for example, for the right to drive, in order to send a very clear message to Saudi society that they not get any ideas, that his decision to allow women to drive was his decision only, and not a result of civil society activism and campaigning. So it was really a very clear message to all of Saudi society not to get ideas that because he was making this reform, he was open to being swayed by civil society.
I'm speaking with Sarah Lee Whitson, the executive director of the Middle East and North Africa Division with Human Rights Watch. Sarah, I want to also let our listeners know that it's not just, we talked about Yemen, we talked about inside Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia also has had some pretty high profile conflicts, if you will, with other Western countries that have taken issue with its human rights abuses. And I'm thinking about Canada, for example. Can you give us a little bit more on that?
In response to the Canadian foreign ministers, I think merely tweeting about the continued detention of a blogger in Saudi Arabia named Raif Badawi, who was sentenced to 10 years in prison and thousands of lashes, which they've since ceased implementing because it was just too embarrassing when the inevitable camera would capture him being lashed by Saudi officials. Because he is married to a Canadian resident, someone who's sought citizenship now in Canada, the Canadian government has spoken on Raif's behalf. The response to that from the Saudi government, from the Crown Prince, really reflects his rather impetuous, impulsive, angry impulses, was to try to punish Canada by withdrawing thousands of Saudi students studying there, Saudi citizens seeking medical care there, and threatening to cut off business ties with Canada, as well as recalling its ambassador. You know, I think, of course, part of it is to send a message to other states of the punishments that Saudi Arabia will exercise should they criticize the country's record, should they criticize the country's violations. But really, I think it was just also a reflection of his erratic nature in lashing out in a way that really only created far more attention to what the Canadian foreign minister had said than would otherwise have been the case. And so what we've consistently seen from the Crown Prince is impulsive, impetuous, acting out like a five-year-old toddler who doesn't get his way.
You know, one of the things that we talked about yesterday on the show was our economic relationship with the Saudis. And I'm wondering, given all the history, and there are many more examples that we haven't gotten to yet, but why is it that the United States remains so closely allied with Saudi Arabia? I mean, is there anything... even when we're seeing the response to Khashoggi's disappearance, right? It's sort of hedging to see what ends up happening. Can anything actually be done to push back on these human rights abuses, given this very close economic relationship?
Well, absolutely. And I think it's very important across the board to separate American business relationships, transactional relationships, from our diplomatic, social relationships with abusive governments. First of all, the U.S. should not itself be implicated in abuses, which it currently is with respect to the war in Yemen, not only because of its supply of weapons to Saudi Arabia, American bombs, have been documented by Human Rights Watch and other organizations to be used.
And the president has suggested that he probably will not implement any arms sanctions or arms deals, you know, if if that's one avenue. So the arms sales look like they'll continue.
Well, I don't know that they will necessarily continue because Congress has a say and has a voice in this. And they do have the capacity to condition arms sales. And they have the capacity to raise the costs for what we've seen from the Secretary of State's waivers of those conditions. There does reach a point when it becomes unsustainable to continue with arms sales in the face of atrocities that are receiving widespread international attention.
Are we close to that point?
Well, we've come close to that point repeatedly in Europe. Germany suspended arms sales. Spain promised to. The Netherlands has suspended arms sales. You know, they are jigging and jagging back and forth, but clearly the pressure is there. You know, these are all, you know, this is not just to sanction Saudi Arabia. It's to avoid implicating Americans in war crimes. It's to avoid creating the conditions that will naturally create blowback from Americans. And we've seen that over many decades, that when the U.S. is implicated in terrible abuses in the Middle East, Americans then become targets of retaliation. So it's a national security interest as well.
You know, there's also the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has also been trying to recreate the image of Saudi Arabia, given all of these human rights abuses, and make it more seem like it's more of a progressive and modern country. What has that looked like so far? I'm thinking women being given the right to vote, the right to drive. Right? Is that one example of that?
That is one example of that. Women in Saudi Arabia have now joined the 21st century with the abolition of the restriction on their right to drive, as well as the promise to open movie theaters, which is considered a revolutionary move in 2018 in Saudi Arabia.
Is a lot of this optics, though, or is it real change?
No, I think it's certainly real. You know, when women take the wheel, it means they have some freedom of movement. And the ban on their driving was 100% about controlling women's freedom of movement. So women in Saudi Arabia still can't travel without the permission of a male guardian. And Saudi women who've managed to escape Saudi Arabia have found themselves facing threats of abduction, attempted abductions, and actual abduction by Saudi government officials who've literally dragged them back to the country. And so it is a loosening of that restriction. And I think it's a smart move by MBS to tap into the majority of his population who are under the age of 30 and who don't understand why their country is so behind the times in these basic things. That's extremely embarrassing. When people talk about Saudi Arabia, the number one example they would always give is that, well, women can't drive there. So it's taken that talking point away at what has turned out to be very minimal cost. For decades, the Saudi government's defense for continuing to create this ban on women driving was that the public would revolt against the government if they changed it. He has called the bluff of all of those threats as to why Saudi can't make changes. And so certainly now we want to see other changes like lifting the bans on women's right to marry. Women can't get married in Saudi Arabia without their male guardian's permission.
Sarah Lee Whitson is Executive Director of the Middle East and North Africa Division with Human Rights Watch. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.